All right, let's dive into something pretty fascinating today. Blinding in research.
Oh, yeah.
So, we talk a lot about randomized controlled trials,
Right.
RCTs, and how important they are to figure out if a treatment really works. Like, that's kind of the gold standard, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They're the gold standard for a reason.
Yeah.
Really try to minimize bias.
Right?
Make sure you're comparing apples to apples when
Yeah.
you're looking at new treatments.
But there's kind of this whole other layer to RCTs, and I don't know, I guess you could almost call it trickery, to make sure they're truly reliable. And that's where blinding comes in. Are you
Yeah.
familiar with this?
Blinding is all about keeping people in the dark
Yeah.
about who's getting what treatment.
Right?
It's like a magic trick,
Yeah.
making sure nobody knows what's behind the curtain until the big reveal.
Right.
And the coolest part is it's not just about the participants themselves, it's about everyone involved in the research.
So why all the secrecy? I mean, our source here, the 1404 blinding PDF, mentions that things can get pretty dramatic if researchers don't take blinding seriously. So, like, what's the big deal?
Well, think about it this way. Let's say you're testing a new pain reliever.
Okay.
If the doctor knows you're getting the real deal, they might be more likely to kind of ask these leading questions like feeling better, right?
Right.
And you, wanting to please, might downplay any lingering aches.
Oh, so even subconscious bias can have an impact.
Absolutely.
It's like, that time I swore the new coffee blend tasted amazing, but it turned out I just loved the fancy mug they served it in.
Exactly. And it's not just doctors and patients, it's the folks analyzing the data too. They might unconsciously give more weight to results from the treatment group if they know who's who.
Oh, wow.
Blinding keeps everyone honest, even if they don't realize they're being swayed.
So it's like this security system protecting the whole trial from bias sneaking in. It's fascinating. Now, our source mentions different levels of blinding. It's like there are different degrees of secrecy. Can you break those down for us?
Think of it like a security system with multiple layers.
Okay.
The more layers you have, the harder it is for bias to sneak in.
Right.
So the simplest level is called open label,
Okay.
where everybody knows who's getting what.
Okay.
Then there's single blind, where either the patient or the clinician is kept in the dark,
Right.
usually the patient.
But wouldn't a doctor's demeanor change if they knew a patient was on a placebo?
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's why we aim for a higher level of security.
Okay.
We call that double blind,
Okay.
where both the patient and the investigator are unaware of the treatment assignments.
So patient and the doctor are both in the dark.
Right.
Gotcha. But wait, there's one more level. Triple blind.
Yes.
Do we bring in like ninjas and secret agents? What happens there?
Not quite ninjas, but
Oh,
we add
God.
another layer of secrecy. In a triple blind trial, the data analysts, the folks crunching the numbers,
Right.
they are also kept in the dark.
Oh,
This
wow.
way, even their interpretations of the results
Right.
are protected from bias.
Wow, so triple blind is like Fort Knives for research.
Yes, exactly.
But our source also mentions this term unblinding. What's that all about?
That's when, for ethical or safety reasons, we have to break the code
Right.
and reveal who got what treatment. So, if someone has a severe reaction,
Right, patient safety
knowing what they received can be crucial for their care.
trumps the need for secrecy.
Exactly.
But I imagine that unplanned unblinding could really mess things up.
You hit the nail on the
Yeah.
head. It's like a puzzle where someone spilled coffee on a few pieces. It can make it difficult to see the full picture clearly.
There's one more point I want to unpack before we move on.
Okay.
Our source says that blinding may not even be possible or
Right.
ethical for some trials.
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
Right. Imagine comparing a new surgical technique to medication.
Okay.
It's pretty tricky to keep the surgeons in the dark about who's getting cut open.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a tough one to blind.
Exactly.
So we've covered blinding, we talked about its importance and when it's not even possible. But there's another concept that's closely related that we need to discuss, and that's allocation concealment.
Yes, this is all about making sure the assignments to treatment or
Oops.
placebo groups
Uh-huh.
are completely random and secret,
Okay.
even before anyone sets foot in the trial.
So is this like blinding's, less glamorous but equally important cousin?
Exactly. Blinding is about keeping secrets during the trial.
Okay.
Allocation concealment is about keeping secret before it even starts.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Can you give me an example of why that's so important?
Sure. Let's say we're testing a new weight loss drug.
Okay.
Imagine a clinician knows that the next slot in the trial is assigned to the placebo group.
Okay.
If a particularly motivated patient walks in,
yeah,
they might be tempted to, quote, accidentally schedule them for a later date, hoping they land in the drug group instead.
So even with good intentions, a clinician could, you know,
absolutely
mess things up if they know the assignment.
Exactly.
Okay. That makes allocation concealment super important.
It does.
This is fascinating.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there are some really clever ways that researchers ensure this happens.
Yep.
But we'll save those details for the next part of our deep dive. So stay tuned to learn more about allocation concealment
right.
and how it helps us trust research findings even more.
Awesome. I'm excited to hear more about that.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back.
You know, after that last segment, I'm like seriously impressed with all the things researchers do to make sure trials are, you know, fair and accurate.
Yeah.
It's like this whole secret world of safeguards that I just never even knew existed.
Mm.
But before we get totally lost in this whole spy thriller thing, you mentioned some pretty clever methods for making sure allocation concealment happens.
Right.
So tell me more about that. What do researchers actually do?
Yeah, they use some pretty ingenious methods, actually. One of the most common approaches is using something called a centralized randomization service.
Okay, a centralized, what is that?
So picture this. You've got your eager participants all ready to enroll in the trial, and the researchers all excited to get things going.
Okay.
But instead of the researchers themselves deciding who goes where,
right,
they call up this independent service, kind of like a research lottery.
Oh.
And that service then randomly assigns each participant to a group,
right,
either treatment or control,
right,
without anyone else knowing the outcome beforehand.
Oh, so it takes it completely out of human hands.
Exactly.
So there's no chance of, you know, even subconscious bias coming in.
Exactly.
Very clever. But what about those situations where you can't blind everyone involved? Like the surgery versus medication example we talked about.
Right.
How does allocation concealment work then?
Well, that's where things get even more interesting.
Okay.
Let's say we're comparing a new minimally invasive surgical technique to traditional open surgery.
Right.
Obviously, the surgeons themselves can't be blinded.
Right.
They know what kind of incision they're making. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
The person assessing the patient's recovery afterwards.
Okay.
Let's say a physical therapist,
mm-hmm,
they could be totally unaware of which surgery the patient received.
So you can still build in some level of blinding,
right,
even if you can't blind everyone from the beginning.
Precisely.
It's like this strategic game of smoke and mirrors.
Exactly.
To keep that bias away.
You got it.
Okay, so centralized services, mm-hmm, strategic blinding.
Yeah.
Researchers have this whole toolbox to use.
Yeah.
But are there any situations where these high-tech methods aren't possible?
There are, you know, especially in settings with limited resources or technology. Sometimes more traditional methods are used. Remember SNOEs?
Oh, yeah.
Serially numbered, opaque, sealed envelopes.
The old school method.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it does sound a bit quaint in this age of, you know, everything being digital.
Right.
But I guess it still works.
You'd be surprised how effective it can be. Each envelope contains a pre-assigned treatment allocation.
Right.
And they're opened sequentially as participants enroll in the trial.
Okay.
And those opaque envelopes, well, that ensures that nobody can peek.
Right.
And potentially, you know, manipulate the assignments.
Right.
So it's low tech, but surprisingly reliable.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
It seems like researchers are always finding ways to adapt and innovate.
Right.
To keep their trials on the up and up no matter what.
That's right.
It really makes me rethink how I look at research findings.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing to think about how much is going on behind the scenes.
You've hit the nail on the head. Research is a really meticulous process.
Yeah.
And these safeguards, although we don't always see them,
right,
are crucial for building trust in the results.
Yeah.
And knowing these techniques exist should give you, the listener, more confidence.
Right.
When you encounter research findings, whether it's in a news article, a scientific journal, or even just a casual conversation.
It's like having a secret decoder ring for the world of research.
Exactly.
But we have one more question to address.
Okay.
How can we, as, you know, everyday people,
right,
use this knowledge to look at the research we see in the real world?
That's a great question. And it's the perfect lead-in to the final part of our deep dive.
Okay.
We're going to equip you with the knowledge and tools to become savvy research detectives.
Awesome.
Ready to spot those potential biases and really assess the credibility of the findings.
Okay, I'm ready.
Stay tuned for more.
All right, welcome back for the final part of our deep dive. It's been quite a journey, right? learning about all the strategies researchers use behind the scenes to make sure we can trust their findings.
It's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. But, you know, we get bombarded with research findings every single day, right?
Absolutely. And every day.
Headlines, social media, even just, you know, chatting with people.
Yeah, everywhere.
So knowing how to figure out what to trust, that's really important.
It is, yeah. It's crucial these days.
Yeah, it's like everyone's an expert all of a sudden, quoting studies left and right.
Right, right.
But now, you know, we've learned about all this stuff, blinding and allocation concealment. I feel like I have this new superpower to be more critical.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we actually use this knowledge, like in the real world?
Good question.
When we're, you know, just out there living our lives.
Think of it this way. You're now armed with a set of detective tools.
Okay.
Whenever you see a research finding that grabs your attention, first thing to do is look for evidence of blinding and allocation concealment.
Okay, so I'm like, what? Scanning for clues.
Exactly.
What am I actually looking for?
Okay, let's say you're reading an article about, I don't know, a new treatment for insomnia.
Okay.
The first question to ask is, was this study blinded?
Okay.
And if so, who was blinded?
Right. Just the participants. Or were the researchers and the people evaluating the outcomes also kept in the dark?
Right. Right, because we learned the more blinding, the better.
Exactly.
What if the article doesn't mention blinding at all? Is that a bad sign?
I'd say it's definitely a yellow flag.
Okay.
It doesn't automatically mean the research is flawed, but you should proceed with caution.
Okay.
The absence of blinding or, right, you know, just vague descriptions of the methods.
Right.
Those are signs to maybe dig a little deeper, consider the potential for bias.
So it's like a little voice saying, maybe don't jump to conclusions just yet.
Exactly.
We need a little more information.
Right.
And same for allocation concealment.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Look for clear descriptions of how they assigned people to the different groups.
Right.
Did they use that centralized randomization service?
Right.
SNOSE? Something else entirely.
Right. Because if they knew who was getting what ahead of time, that could really skew things. Exactly. And the more detail they provide about these methods, mm-hmm, the more confident you can be that they, you know, tried to minimize bias.
Right.
Ensure the integrity of the findings. It's a sign they're being transparent and rigorous.
This is amazing. I feel like I've gone from blindly trusting everything I read to actually being able to think critically about it.
Exactly.
And say, wait a minute, hold on. I need more information.
That's the goal.
Yeah, this is really cool.
We want to give you the knowledge and the skills to navigate this complex world of research informed decisions about, you know, your health, your life, even the world around you.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up here, what's the final takeaway for our listeners?
Well, remember, research is this ongoing process of discovery.
Yeah.
You know, new findings are coming out all the time.
All the time.
But by understanding these principles of blinding and allocation concealment,
right,
you have the power to be a smarter consumer of research. Question those assumptions, evaluate the evidence, and make informed decisions.
This has been an incredible journey. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
As we went on this deep dive into the world of blinding and allocation concealment.
Yeah.
We hope you learned something.
You'd hope so.
And that you feel empowered.
Absolutely.
To, you know, look at research a little more critically from now on.
Yeah, that's the goal.
So until next time, stay curious.
Stay curious.
Yeah.